each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, along with the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame, joined by my colleague and co-host, Loretta Frelick, former prosecutor for the Illinois State's Attorney's Office in Cook County, primarily, where she has more than 70 jury trials, right?
Yes.
Under her belt and done. So quite an expert on the topic we're going to talk about today.
Oh, I don't know about that, but well, I have been in the arena.
You know more than you know enough to be dangerous.
There you go.
And more than me. So,
I don't know anybody knows more than you, Mary.
Trying to think of a guest about, for the topic we want to discuss, we didn't need one because we have you. Because you have a lot more. At least, you know all the ins and outs. So, and if you have not guessed by now, what we're going to spend some time discussing is the trial and acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse and some of the reactions to that and why the jury may or may not have made some of the decisions that they did. But before we get to that, we can't start this show and start a conversation about something else in Wisconsin without talking about the horrific tragedy that occurred yesterday at a Christmas parade, a vehicular massacre, I think is about the only way you could fairly describe it. Man in a large red SUV who plowed into a group of women who called themselves, I think, the grannies who dance or something like that, and then a number of school children, and killing five, 40 are injured. Many of the injuries are believed to be serious, involving head and neck and other injuries. And so obviously our thoughts and prayers in a very particular way go out to the families of the dead and the wounded. And also, as Loretta reminded me earlier today, we need to pray for the perpetrator because you have to be, in a either a particular mindset or manipulated by a particular kind of evil to do something so heinous. And I haven't even been able to watch the video yet. I watched just up until the point, but that man had to be going 50 or 60 miles an hour when he plowed into those people. And did you watch any of the coverage,
Loretta?
I did watch
it. I did. And you know what I find so sad, in addition to obviously the lost lives, the 40 people injured, 18 of them are children.
Yeah.
The other group that's traumatized are the people who were victimized when they saw it happen.
Yeah.
And what's so sad to me is what we're going to talk about next. Here, Wisconsin has an opportunity to put that aside. Let it be.
Yeah.
The jury made the decision.
The Rittenhouse trial is done.
Right. Yeah. But now they're in the attempts to move on. They're having a local holiday parade, and bringing some joy and some anticipation for Christmas and the Christ child and peace and all that good stuff that we associate with the holidays.
And the parade couldn't happen last year because of COVID.
Right.
So they haven't had it, I think, now in 2 years. They haven't had the parade. And so Or maybe it was just last year that it was canceled. But at any rate, they hadn't.
Right.
It was not held last year. That I know for sure. And so here are the kids probably looking forward in great anticipation.
Totally.
And it's a big community event with a lot of school bands and whatever the dancing grannies, you know, whatever they.
They're all local.
They're local. And apparently they march in a lot of parades. They lost at least two of their members. They posted on their Facebook page this morning. And then just to your point about the people who both witnessed what happened. You know, there was one man who shoved his son out of the way and then took the full brunt of the car. I believe he's one of the deceased, but the names will likely be released this afternoon at the 1 o'clock press conference that the local police and sheriff's department are going to have, I think, jointly. So you know, prayers for Waukesha and also for Kenosha. And we don't know if the two are linked. They may be. The man, if the early reports about him are accurate, was out on a $1,000 cash bond for a felony and had previous felony convictions. So it really is just an unspeakable tragedy committed by somebody who, in my opinion, shouldn't have been out to begin with. And just that the lives of so many people right before the holidays being impacted by this now, it's just unspeakably sad and tragic and really hard to wrap your mind around. And,
yes.
You know, and again, as I was starting to say to your point about those who witnessed and then tried to help, apparently a lot of people were doing chest compressions and were cradling people. I saw one post by a woman who said she cradled a little girl. And she said the girl started to have a seizure and blood was coming out of her ears. And so just she must have had sustained a significant head injury. And then the mother collapsed in front of her. And just, you know, you never the kind of PTSD that comes from witnessing and being drawn into and absorbed by that kind of tragedy. It takes years and years for you to be able to process that kind of trauma. So,
and you mentioned earlier this morning in the news reported that there was a priest from Milwaukee and the Archdiocese of Milwaukee issued a statement. And one of the things that they did is they also said how our prayers are with all those traumatized, not just the dead and the injured, but with those who are traumatized.
It was a short statement, but it was a very good statement.
Yes.
And I'm grateful that they put that out. So there was the other good part about that too is, you know, rumors had started to spread that, you know, all the Catholic schools in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee are closed today because of this. And so rumors had started to spread very quickly that there were a group of kids from a particular elementary school, along with the priest from their parish, who were struck. And so I'm glad they got out in front of it before, you know, speculation went rampant and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is not just a perfunctory, please keep them in your thoughts and prayers. This is a very heartfelt request. We know many of you, if not most of you who listen to this program, are serious people about your praying and interceding for those in need. And this is really a case where that's necessary. So that all being said, if we get any updates via the news media during the show, we'll break in and update you along the way, though we're not anticipating anything till about 1 o'clock this afternoon, Central Time. That is Chicago time, which is also Milwaukee and Waukesha time.
There's a lot of Milwaukees in Waukesha
and
Kenosha.
And the Native, I know, the Native American based tribe names that are so part of the culture in Wisconsin. So at any rate, so sad way to start the show, but could not go without mentioning that. So,
and Mary, it is a hopeful way to start the show because what we're saying is nothing is impossible with God.
That's true. Yeah.
Luke 1:37.
Yep.
And so all of our listeners' prayers count.
Yes. No, they do.
Yes.
And God's word doesn't return to him void. So we just remember that. And, you know, anything that we could, you know, do in terms of supporting this family through prayer. And that's what we can do now. You don't know them. You don't know their names, but God does. And
absolutely.
You don't need to know anything more about them, you know. So.
Except they need prayer, and they need a miracle.
Yes, some of them do, yeah. Some of them will need absolute miracles to pull through. So, let's rewind to last week. I watched 2 weeks ago. It'll be 2 weeks ago Wednesday, Kyle Rittenhouse took the stand, which I thought was a brave move. But also to me, indicated that he knew he was innocent and that there was nothing he was trying to conceal from either the jury or the judge or the general public. So let me just set it up for you, for those who don't have the all the details. In August of 2020, a black man named Jacob Blake, for whom there was an outstanding arrest warrant, was shot by the Kenosha police as he resisted arrest. None of the police who were involved in the shooting of Jacob Blake have been charged. He had reached down for a knife that he had, and the police did open fire on him. And this was after several attempts to arrest him, attempts which he resisted.
He also had his children in the car and had just come from a domestic situation that the officers were responding to.
Correct.
And he was trying to leave with the children, and there is some concern that he was not supposed to be.
Yes. No. So there were just dramatic concerns all the way around. And, you know, it's really just very striking. And that particular event, Mr. Blake did not die. He struck a deal with the prosecutors and I believe got 2 years probation for his resisting arrest. The police officers were not charged in his shooting, but that just triggered riots and looting and vandalism in the community of Kenosha.
Yes.
And a young man named Jacob Blake, sorry, not Jacob Blake, that's the name of the black man who was shot.
Kyle Rittenhouse,
who was at the time a 17-year-old who lived in Antioch, Illinois. And for those of you not familiar with that neck of the woods, Antioch's, 15, 20 minutes from the Wisconsin border. So he lived in Antioch, Illinois. His parents are divorced. His father lives in Kenosha, as does his grandmother. And he worked in nearby Pleasant Prairie. So he was always going back and forth between his home in Antioch, his mother's home, his dad's home in Kenosha, his job in Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin. So one of the first things you started to hear was that 17-year-old took a rifle and crossed state lines. I mean, as if, I don't know, I go to Wisconsin all the time. I've never needed a passport, and Indiana and Michigan, because we live, you know, we're so close to a bunch of different states here.
But if you do cross state lines with the gun, Mary, you need a concealed carry.
Okay, and you need a permit.
Yes,
correct.
You need a permit. Right. And also something to remember is that you need to meet some age requirements. And
right.
At 17.
Right. But the fact of the matter is, he didn't bring the gun with him.
Right.
The gun was being kept in Wisconsin.
In fact, his mother drove him.
Yes. That's right. His mother drove him. His mother drove him.
So his mother drove him.
You get the media that paint this picture of this guy grabbing a rifle and jumping in the car and taking off to go shoot people. Not
Can't you just hear the witch music from Wizard of Oz? Dun, 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 dun,
and so, dun, and dun. He really was somebody, you do get the sense, really wanted to be involved in either something like law enforcement or he wanted to be a paramedic.
He's like a junior cadet at
something
some
like
police
that. Yeah, and was a lifeguard. So he has some basic, you know, life-saving training, CPR, that sort of stuff. And unfortunately, the violence and the looting and the rioting in Kenosha was so overwhelming to the police department there that they sort of gave up just trying to police, you know, things that were going on. And a used car lot was being set on fire and the high school had been vandalized. So we first went to the high school, correct?
And I'm not sure where he first went, but I know he went with a medic kit.
Right. He went with his medic kit.
And, he's not a medic.
Right. But he had a kit.
He had his kit
and
to
he
help
brought
people.
That with and went to the high school to help clean graffiti off the high school.
High school walls.
Then went with, I believe, two other friends over to this used car lot where he encountered multiple different protesters, many of them who were not from Kenosha. Some of them were from, you know, several hours away, but who had come to participate in, you know, what some called peaceful protesting, but was fairly evident was, you know, rioting. One of them had a gun. One of them was hitting people with a skateboard. Mr. Rosenbaum, who seems to have received the bulk of the focus, was convicted felon. He had just been released from a psychiatric hospital. What he was doing there, I'm not sure, but he was threatening people leading up to all of this. And Kyle Rittenhouse sort of got caught up in the melee, was chased by one of the suspects, beaten over the head with a skateboard by another suspect, took his Glock gun and pointed it in his face.
Well, the first one was Joseph Rosenblum.
Right.
And he was lunging for the gun that Kyle Correct. Was carrying.
Correct.
And he chased him down, and he was the aggressor in that first encounter.
Yes, correct.
And then the other individual is Anthony Huber, and he was trying to take the gun away from Kyle, and he was hitting him in the head with the skateboard. And the video bears this out.
It's very clear, yeah.
You know, he's laying on the ground, and the guy is hitting him over the head with the skateboard. Now, I can tell you from personal experience, a head injury can do as much damage short of death, yep. and I would wish it on no one.
Yep.
So as he's defending himself from the guy hitting him on the skateboard, he then gets away. He shoots him. He gets away. In one of the videos, he's trying to turn himself in, it
right.
looks like, to the police truck that's driving away.
Right.
And then the third victim, the witness who testified, he even acknowledged that he pointed his gun
right.
at Kyle and then was shot in the arm. And there were two other individuals, Richard McGinnis, who pointed his handgun at Kyle, and an unknown male.
Right.
So when the jury read all of those—
The five charges.
—verdicts—
Right.
—they clearly had an opportunity. And this is, I cannot tell you from a prosecutor's perspective, I cannot tell you the importance of the fact that all of the jurors heard all of the evidence. They heard and they saw the video. They heard the testimony mm-hmm. of all the witnesses. And what's really just, you know, what people neglect to recall is they're crying out for Kyle Rittenhouse's head. They were then given jury instructions.
Right.
They were given the Wisconsin—
Very explicitly.
Yes.
The judge really patiently. I was amazed at how long the description of the jury instructions. What? Tell me about that, like, just in terms of your own experience with that sort of thing.
Well, first of all, you will have had a jury instruction conference. You will have had that event. Now, I don't know how they do it in Wisconsin. I can just tell you in Illinois. You will have a jury instruction conference. You will provide instructions that mirrors the law. So when we come back, I will be happy to just give you kind of an overview of that process.
That would be fantastic. Yeah, I think this is why I'm so grateful for your you know, incredible years of experience in dealing with this. So, well, listeners, please don't go away. When we come back, Loretta Freilich is going to walk us through the jury instruction process and what happens normally during a criminal trial. And we'd really like it if you wait, and we can explain this to you so that if this comes up at your holiday table on Thanksgiving, you'll have information that with which to perhaps diffuse an angry or, you know, heated conversation. So please don't go away. This is Loretta Freilich and Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony, as we do every Monday here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750, simulcast on FM 88.5, WSFI, Chicagoland's voice for EWTN Radio. Don't go away.
The cold and snow is just about here. And so, Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stanislaus Kostka is asking for donations of new or used men's winter coats. You may drop them off Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 12 noon at the Soup Kitchen off the church parking lot. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. Thank you for your generosity.
I'm Loretta Freilich, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org. www.waukesha.org.
Welcome back. This is Loretta Frelick and Mary Fiorito filling in for Father Anthony on Winds of Change. And we are discussing the mechanics of the Rittenhouse trial right now. And one of the things that people need to remember is once you become a juror, you have sworn to follow the law as it is given to you. And one of the admonishments that the judge will possibly say is, you know, you're not allowed to go to the crime scene. You're not allowed to watch any videos about it. And sometimes that's like going back, like in this case, back to 2020. You're not allowed to do your own research. So what happens is all of the evidence is put in the trial. You can consider nothing beyond the evidence. You can't think, well, what I've been dealing with most of my friends, well, we can all agree that his mom never should have brought him there. You know what? That's irrelevant. Whether mom brought him, whether she should have brought him, not pertinent to the facts. Mm-hmm. You can only put the facts and your common sense into the deliberations, and you must view this in light of the jury instructions that are given to you. Now, Mary, you remarked about how the time that he took to read them, the attention to detail. What happens in a jury trial is, depending on the charge, you prepare, as the prosecutor, jury instructions. And some of those admonishments are there that, you know, you're sworn to uphold the law. And in order to prove, and each crime has to be laid out. So the first one was the intentional homicide.
Right.
In order to prove intentional homicide, you have three elements that you have to meet.
Okay.
In the event you meet all of these, you find the defendant guilty. If you don't meet all of these, you find the defendant not guilty.
Right.
And I think that it's horrific that two people died and one person was seriously injured. But based on the evidence the jury heard, and this was not a quick decision, they wrestled with it.
Yes, because I was quite as it went on, I thought you can speak to this as well. But my understanding is that usually if a jury is coming back quickly, they're going to acquit, and the longer they stay out
or find them guilty.
Yes, right.
A quick verdict.
Right. Either way.
Yes.
Quick verdict. But it seems they really.
Yes.
It was a thoughtful decision. It was not knee jerk. They clearly had not all made up their minds ahead of time. So,
Right.
But I thought the longer it went, my thought was, well, they're going to find him probably guilty in one of the five or, two of the five, what have you.
Well, and remember, too, he started this trial with six charges.
Mm-hmm.
But the state did not meet its burden of showing the gun was a certain length.
Right.
So the judge at the end of all the evidence and before it went to the jury, the judge eliminated that count from their consideration.
So there had been six and then that went down to.
Yeah. Right. So what you also want to look at is these people, you can't make, you're looking at it as a horrific incident. And a life was lost in two men on the street that night. But that's not what you can look at. You have to look to see, was he proven guilty? And here's the other clicker, beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
And while this is not a legal definition, because there really is no definition for reasonable doubt. But the way you look at a criminal case is you have to, and we're all in the football season.
Right.
You have to move that ball from the other team's 1 yard line all the way to, or from your 1 yard line to the other team's.
Right.
Okay. So that's like that's like 99%.
Okay.
Now, a reasonable doubt doesn't mean any doubt. So in the instance where you had the one man who was unknown male and we didn't have their name of someone else he shot, that doesn't mean just because we don't have that, he could not have been found guilty of that.
Right.
The other thing to take into consideration is, and why things, if they move forward in a civil trial, you only have to prove him guilty by 51%, a preponderance of the evidence.
Okay.
So going forward, you know, we'll talk about that later. He may be facing civil charges from people whom he shot, their families. But right now for the criminal trial, it is a horrendous burden, and it's on the state. Mm-hmm. And that's why, in closing arguments, the state speaks first, the defense then argues, and then
the state can rebut.
Has rebut. And, yeah. And again, can only address things that were in the rebuttal, in the closing argument. Only statements that can be addressed are what the defense argued in closing. Okay. So it's not like a second closing.
You can't redo the whole trial again can only respond to things that were said by the defense counsel during his rebuttal.
Right.
Okay.
And the one thing that I did find unusual, and I still haven't found an answer for it, the judge letting them take the instructions home.
Yeah, that was interesting. And I think, was it just one juror that was allowed to take the instructions home?
All of them were allowed. But what I was—
And why is that so unusual? Unpack that a little bit.
Because they are a collective body. It is the jury that, you know, all through the trial, the judge is admonishing them, don't talk about this trial until I give you your instructions. Don't talk about this trial until I'm giving you your instructions. So when they were allowed to take those home, one, I think that everybody then had additional time to deliberate on them.
Right.
But the instructions are what get them to reach their conclusion.
Right.
And it's important that they that they review this evidence together.
Right.
Because had they had to use an alternate, they would have had to start deliberations all over again.
Wow.
So if somebody had gotten sick or had, you know, like there was one juror that
there was one
juror
that was dismissed.
There was one juror that was dismissed for making some
off-cuff joke or something
about
like that.
Jacob Blake.
Yes.
So that sheriff appropriately reported that to the judge, and the judge excused him.
Right.
So I think that to send them home with the instructions allowed them to consider this case apart from being in the group
in the
of
jury
the
room.
Jury.
Right. Yeah, because they're a body. Yeah, that's a very good point that you raise. And though to me, that seems to have given a little bit of an edge, if you will, to the state.
Yeah. No.
I don't. That's how I saw it. I thought, well, he's
giving.
Why did
you say it that way?
I guess just because if they were looking for a way to be able to convict him of something, they needed to really look at what their instructions were as to how they were to view certain actions and evidence, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess that's how I looked at it. Secondly, I thought the judge was giving the state a heck of a lot of leeway, even though he was, you know, very angry at that prosecutor from time to time. It was like a Law and Order episode. I could not believe
the
way the prosecutor spoke to the judge. First of all, it was a little cheeky. And then the way the judge just came down on him. I mean, he seems like a very kind man, and it seemed very out of character, to me at least. But boy, did he let him have it a couple of times.
And well, he did a couple of things that he should have.
Yes, correct.
The video was the big issue. And for our listeners that didn't have an opportunity to view the entire trial, the state video that we were able to watch was super clear. It was crisp. You could see, I mean, you could recognize Kyle Rittenhouse.
Right, it was clear it was him. Yep.
Yes. The same video, but a lower level of the definition and the color, it was dull and grainy.
Okay.
That's what was given to the defense.
Okay.
So basically, the prosecutor, I'm not going to say that he did or he didn't, may have committed an error in not turning over the clear version so that the state could or the defense could have an opportunity to view it in the clarity. It might have changed the trial with some of those.
Right.
You know, that clearly some of those counts where the gun's getting pointed at Kyle.
Right.
And it's clear it's an issue of self-defense. You know, maybe one of the counts could have been dismissed.
Altogether, yeah. Well, right. What was supposed to have been the state's star witness, the Gage Kreutz, long German name, and I'm mispronouncing it. I'm botching it, but I think you know who, because there was only, of the three people he shot, only one survived, and he was the state's star witness. Admitted, I mean, I don't know, was he not prepped well, or was it, but admitted under oath that he pointed his gun at Kyle Rittenhouse before Kyle Rittenhouse shot him.
You know, Mary, I'm
astounded that they put that man.
You know what,
stand.
Mary, it would not be the first time in myself with as many juries as I've participated in that I've leaned, or trials, even bench trials,
yeah,
where I've leaned over to my partner after my witness is on the stand testifying that I've prepped, and now they're being cross-examined, and I lean over to my partner and say, well, that's the first time I'm hearing it,
yes,
too.
So, what just happened here?
And so I think that, you know, we need to remember how important our jury system is.
Right.
How incredibly gifted we are to live in a nation where our peers judge us on the evidence.
Right.
And I can honestly tell you that I'm always impressed with the seriousness of the event.
Yeah.
And I've seen jurors come in for voir dire, and they're wearing blue jeans and a ratty old T-shirt, and there I am. They show up for the trial, and they're wearing a suit and a tie.
Wow. Yeah.
Because this jury is overwhelming. You know, the tension of everybody watching you testify. Obviously, it was on national television.
Right.
So, you know, there's something about the goodness of man that I got to believe. You just tell the truth.
Yeah.
And it's, the truth is easier than a lie.
Right, right.
So,
and, well, were you surprised there wasn't a mistrial?
No, I think the opportunity was there.
Yeah.
And if you notice, the judge held back a couple of his rulings. Well, let's wait and see what happens at the end of the jury.
Right.
I think there might have been, had the verdict been different.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly were some errors that the judge was telling everyone he was going to address,
right,
at the end of these proceedings.
Right. And as it happened, he didn't have to.
He didn't,
yeah,
have
so
to.
So he could have declared a mistrial even, right, after, if the verdict had come back guilty in all the counts.
He could have.
Yeah.
Weighing the evidence, they would have had to argue that. But, you know, he just did such a nice job with the jury.
Even though I was quite impressed
with him. He's yelling at the defense, but the state, but nobody has to worry. The jury's not in the room.
The jury didn't hear any of that. Right. Just so people are clear, during those kind of explosive moments in the trial, the jury was not in the room to hear that.
No.
Yeah. So, you know what? You mentioned perhaps the families suing Kyle Rittenhouse civilly for those deaths.
Right.
And there's a lower standard,
yes,
in the civil court system. And that's how, you know, for example, the best known case of this is O.J. Simpson, right?
Right.
So he was not guilty criminally.
He's still looking for the killer.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. But he's in prison now, is he not? On something else?
No, I think he's out
is
on
he
prison.
Out? Okay.
He's out on the robbery of his paraffin, of his trophies. And
yeah, something like that.
Sports memorabilia.
But he was sued civilly,
yes,
by his victims and his victim's, yes, estate, and won. So, and they won. And,
yes.
And so, so the same could happen here. And,
well, wait,
yes,
before you go to your next point, Mary.
Yes, yes.
The same could happen here. What are you going to do? Just get a judgment? You can't get blood from a turnip. And
right.
He's 18 years old now, hasn't worked. And what's interesting was this kid was working,
yeah,
before. He was working part-time.
As a lifeguard, yeah.
And he also got a COVID stimulus check, which is what was used.
Did he really?
Purchase.
Oh, no kidding.
I think tonight on Tucker Carlson, that's where we're going to hear that. But he admitted that he had a COVID stimulus check of $1,200 that he used to purchase the gun.
Oh, that's hilarious. I shouldn't say that. But, you know,
no.
Well, speaking of the government.
Yes.
I was, I'm glad that President Biden acknowledged the verdict of the jury and said,
yes,
he accepted it. But he called that young man a white supremacist.
I know.
And I was hoping he would apologize, say he rushed to judgment,
yeah,
say he misspoke, he didn't have all the facts that came out at the trial. I mean, really, he could be forgiven given the nature of the, you know, of the media reports. He could be forgiven for making that judgment very quickly. He shouldn't have. It's not an excuse. But, you know, if he had just Mary, kind of copped to it.
I got one question for you, Mary.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you honestly think a man who has allowed this nation to be supportive of murdering babies in the womb has any consideration for an 18-year-old man's reputation?
Yeah. No, of course not. Well, speaking of reputations, the other case that this is quite, you know, mindful of or brings to mind is that with Nicholas Sandman and the boys from Covington Catholic High School, you know, trial and conviction by the media within, you know, hours, if not days, of the incident.
In their own high school.
In their own high school, yes, correctly.
The fact that the administrators didn't stand up for those young men.
No,
that especially
it was, it was really, but it just shows you, you know. Well, let's talk about that. We're going to take our next break, listeners, and we'll come back to that, the Covington Catholic High School boys and the similarities and why Nicholas Sandman of Covington Catholic reached out to Kyle Rittenhouse and spoke with him over the weekend. So please don't go away. This is Mary Fiorito, my colleague Loretta Fralick. We are sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750, WNDZ.
Yes, we're still WNDZ.
88.5 FM, WFSI, Chicago's voice for EWTN Radio. Don't go away.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststandschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to the Winds of Change.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule, work, or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, two blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
Welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today with Loretta Fralick for Father Anthony, as we do on most Mondays here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And we were just beginning to discuss the Covington Catholic situation. And for those who don't remember it, that was a group of boys from Covington Catholic High School. And they were at the March for Life with probably tons of other high school kids. I was at the march that year. In fact, was not far from where the boys were gathering. And they were accused by a Native American man of mocking him. Video surfaced very quickly, as well as still pictures that showed kind of an awkward-looking, you know, 16, 17-year-old boy standing on the steps. They weren't on the steps of the Capitol. I'm trying to remember which building we're at. At any rate, they were waiting for their school bus to come, and he was excoriated in the media, called every name under the book, you know, in every major media outlet, jumped on the story. Nobody bothered to check the facts. And it turned out when you did unpack all the facts, it was a very, very different story altogether, much like Kyle Rittenhouse. When you began to unpack all the facts and, you know, saw what really happened, very, very different story from what was portrayed in the media.
Right.
And so Nicholas Sandman filed suit against CNN. and against the Washington Post, received significant settlements from both. In fact, there's a joke going around that he is actually the highest paid correspondent at CNN. So he has been, I follow him on Twitter, and he has been tweeting quite a bit about how he can empathize and sympathize with Kyle Rittenhouse because the same was done to him. He was tried and convicted in the media. I had the opportunity to meet his parents actually at a conference that I was speaking at, and his parents happened to be there as guests. And his mother was just telling me about the harrowing things. I mean, people threatening to kill her, to kill her children, to kill her son, to dismember him, they had to close the high school for a time, that they would douse the high school in gasoline, lock all the boys in there and set it on fire. I mean, just the most vile, vile things. And, you know, a priest that I happened to meet he celebrated the funeral mass for one of my friend's mothers, was standing like 10 feet away from them, maybe that much, and saw the entire thing transpire. And he gave an interview to a radio station in St. Louis and then to a radio station here in Chicago. But boy, his voice was, I mean, he was literally about the closest eyewitness, you know, objective, was just watching the boys, you know, and I, you know, as any Catholic priest would have done when you have a group of high school kids who are at the march, if they had been goofing off, would have gone over to say something to them. I mean, right. That's just not, you know, I know, every year I go and I speak to pretty large groups of high school kids who are there for the march. And if those, I mean, the last time I was there, they offered to carry my luggage. They offered, you know, and I tried to point this out on Twitter, like those kids are on their best behavior
because they
know they put one toe over a line. They're in jug for a week, if not more,
exactly.
If not getting suspended or expelled.
Yes.
So the story, I just remember thinking, hey, wait, maybe we should get all the facts first. If it's true, it's disgraceful and the kid should be reprimanded. But if it's not true, people better just wait, just back off. And I think because it was a pro-life event, Loretta.
It had to have been.
Yeah, because it was a pro-life event. But
And clearly the video shows the other American Indian or indigenous person.
Yes.
Taunting him.
Yes.
I mean, it was as if, are you crazy?
Yeah.
This needs to stop.
Yeah.
And what you're pitting against each other is an older man, an activist. He does this at Washington all the time, coming
right.
with his drum and making noise, and a young 17, 18-year-old man.
Yes.
Who exercised, I think, excellent judgment.
Yeah, and remarkable and restraint under
the
conditions.
Remarkable restraint and discernment.
Yes.
And he was trying to diffuse whatever anger was emanating from the man drumming. So
yes.
It's really, it's, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's almost like setting up this young boy to fail.
Yeah.
And yet he surpassed all of everyone's expectations and blessings on him.
Yes. But he, you know, but suffered tremendously, as did the entire family.
Absolutely.
You know, they had to have 24-hour police protection. I, you know, it's just shocking the way the woke mob will descend on people and you know, egged on by inaccurate media and
the
inaccurate
white supremacist.
Reports. Yes.
The white supremacist.
The president of the United States, although he was the candidate at the time, called him a white supremacist. And then our own governor Pritzker, released a statement that I thought was disgraceful.
Oh, more than
I
disgraceful.
Thought, did you or anyone on your staff even watch 10 minutes of that trial?
Oh, exactly.
Because it was pretty clear when he took the stand that, you know, if he got convicted at all, which he didn't, but there was a significant story out there that was not being told.
Well, and not only was the story not being told, set that aside, this young man was going to prison for life.
Yeah. No, he killed two people. I mean,
he
two people.
He was that was what was weighing in the balance in this trial.
Yeah. Yeah.
That to me was, believe me, beyond my own understanding.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, listeners, that's sort of the wrap up. If you want another good perspective from a media point of view, I would really recommend Barry Weiss. Barry Weiss, now, again, not everybody who I recommend for particular subject matter dissection is somebody who I agree with on every single issue under the planet. And Barry Weiss would be a would be an example of this. She is a former political reporter with the New York Times. She has what is called a Substack with articles that she writes and blog posts, and then a podcast called Common Sense. And in her Common Sense podcast, she broke down what happened in the case and very articulately and with a good investigative journalism hat on, and really brought a lot of wisdom to it. And it was good to see it get so much attention, because if you're listening and you're willing to look at it with an objective, you know, mindset, and not with your mind already made up, then, you know, Bari Weiss is reporting, and she interviewed another reporter who had been there and was following the story very closely. Her podcast is actually called Honestly with Bari Weiss, and then the Substack blog has the other name that I mentioned. So you do want to check her out. The podcast is available at Apple. So if you just go to podcast.apple.com and search for Honestly with Bari Weiss or Bari Weiss, it's the title of this particular podcast is The Media's Verdict on Kyle Rittenhouse. Definitely worth listening to. I learned things, and even I watched the whole trial, and I learned things about the coverage and about the trial from watching that again. She would be Common Sense, again, just to kind of Common Sense is her blog, and Honestly is the podcast.
Well, Mary,
and kind of Common Sense you have to pay for, but you can listen to the podcast for free at Apple Podcasts.
There's another reaction that we need to remember too.
Yes, ma'am.
Kamala Harris.
Oh,
the vice president weighed in, and her reaction to the Rittenhouse verdict.
Okay.
Quote, there's a lot more work to do on justice system reform. They didn't get the verdict they wanted.
No.
And they didn't get.
They're like astounded, aren't they? They're astounded. And I went in there really with an open mind. I thought, what on earth is this kid doing running around with a rifle? But then when I heard all the facts of it. Again, you've got a 17-year-old. They're not exactly known for critical thinking.
Right.
And,
regardless, I'm not excusing.
No, I know you're not. I know you're not. No.
The justice system does not need reform because you didn't get the verdict you wanted.
Right. Maybe the facts weren't as you believed them to be.
As the media told you they were.
Yes. Yeah.
And so.
Well, we're going to go to one more break. And then when we come back, we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk about Thanksgiving and its religious roots with Loretta and Mary.
Yes.
So please don't go away. Mary Fiorito and Loretta Fralick sitting in for Father Anthony on listener-supported Winds of Change.
Here's something that you should know about what's happening at St. Stan's. The Daughters of St. Mary of Providence Religious Order operates the Providence Soup Kitchen on the premises of St. Stanislaus Kostka Parish. The soup kitchen serves a midday meal Monday through Thursday from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Anyone who needs a meal is welcome. If you can volunteer to help and serve meals on a regular basis, please call Sister Darlene at 773-870-2435. That's 773-870-2435. St. Stan's is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
I'm Mary Fiorito, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
This is Loretta Fralick and Mary Fiorito on Winds of Change. And we're going to change it up a little bit after talking about the really sad events in the last couple of weeks and the weekend. And today I wanted to bring something in about Thanksgiving and into our dialogue. And one of the things I love when I start out trying to learn something and then the Lord takes a tangent in a different way. And I read this incredible book called Shaping History Through Prayer and Fasting, and it's by Derek Prince. Derek Prince was he was born in Bangalore, India, to a British military family, and he was a professed atheist until he had an encounter with the Lord. He was very well educated, and once he started that encounter, he had a life-changing experience that changed his entire life. And he was an amazing writer. He's written beautiful books, and he has married women with adopted daughters, and two different times his first wife died, and then he married again another woman who had three daughters. And he lived in Israel. He lived all over the world, and he came to the United States, and he was living in Seattle, and he was speaking, and he was trying to study the roots of America and its fasting and feasting. And so he came across a story that was not written down anywhere, and all the Americans that he spoke to, because remember, he's British, so he wouldn't have this background, came to never know this story until he told it to him. And William Bradford, he was about 36 when he came over here. He was a very religious man, and he was responsible for the Pilgrims. And he wrote a book of Plymouth Plantation. And in it, William Bradford described the Pilgrims' arrival on the Mayflower, all the dangers and hardships of living in America, and answered prayer. So as you sit down for this Thanksgiving, I want you to remember this story, because I think it was not a potluck with Squanto. This was an opportunity to thank God, and here's what they were thanking God for. In 1623, the corn crop that the Pilgrims had carefully planted was threatened. In the summer, there was a great drought. There was, until about the middle of July, there was no rain, and so the corn began to wither, and the ground was dry and parched, and there was nothing that they could do because they didn't have irrigation or any of those talents yet. So what they did was they set aside a solemn day of prayer to seek the Lord by humble and fervent prayer. And the Indians were having, obviously, the indigenous people.
Right.
They were having the same problem, obviously, because this is
right.
a big drought.
It was affecting everybody. Right.
Right. So they gathered together, they prayed, and they wanted the crop saved. And you know, I mean, back in those days,
right.
the crops are gone. There's nothing to eat. You're
going
to die.
There's no jewel to go to.
That's right. And so the first part of the morning, it was still very hot. There were no clouds in the sky. There was no sign of rain. And in the evening, after this day of prayer, it became overcast. And they were looking forward to the rain, and it came that evening. But the rain that came was a different kind of rain than Massachusetts normally experiences. A summer rain in Massachusetts is violent, quick, you know, tumultuous. It would beat down those crops, and what was struggling to survive would have just disappeared. It would have been knocked out.
Right.
But this was a sweet, gentle rain that didn't beat the corn down and was in every way gentle and nourishing to the ground, you know, building it up, getting it, the drought taken care of, and soaking it. And what it did was revive and quicken. This is from William Bradford's book of Plymouth Plantation.
Right.
And this is what these are his words. What did so apparently revive and quicken the decayed corn and other fruits as was wonderful to see, and made the Indians astonished to behold.
And afterwards, so after this drought is satisfied, and one day, the Lord sent them such seasonable showers with interchange of fair, warm weather as through his blessing caused a fruitful and liberal harvest, for which mercy, in time convenient, Thanksgiving, they also set aside a day of Thanksgiving. And so what is important to remember is that, you know, they didn't just come and welcome them and we're going to teach you how to fish and get whatever you need for planting and these are good crops in Massachusetts at this time. No, they recognized a need. They needed a miracle.
Yeah.
They prayed to the Lord and the Indians recognized that it was God who gifted them. It was the pilgrims' God, the Christian God, that gifted them with this water and nourishing the crops and giving them a harvest that mm-hmm. they were then able to celebrate and give thanks to God.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, it's interesting. I had to, for some other work I was doing, do some research on the issue of nativity sets in public spaces. And there's a, you may remember this from con law class, Lynch versus Donnelly, which was the case, the Supreme Court case that held that if religious symbols are in a public space, so for example, a city hall or something like that, or at the, you know, the city park, if it's part of a larger display that is celebrating a holiday, even though that holiday is religious, it's appropriate to have a historical reference to the holiday itself if that holiday is religious, which is right. What a nativity set would be. But it's interesting. In the opinion, I read Chief Justice Warren Burger wrote the opinion, and he specifically references Thanksgiving as a religious holiday.
It is.
He said this is no less religious than Thanksgiving is as a religious holiday. So I thought that was kind of neat that he pointed that out.
And Mary, the leaders of our country were young. I mean, if you ever want to read a good book, there's one on George Washington's prayer life and how he always prayed to God. And the leaders in our nation believed in prayer, but they also believed in thanking God.
Yeah.
And in 1774, I mean, Derek Prince goes on to tell all of these instances. In 1774, the British Parliament ordered an embargo on the port of Boston, Massachusetts. On the day of the embargo, June 1st, there was a resolution by George Washington. And in George Washington's, the diary of George Washington, edited by John Fitzpatrick, George Washington, quoted, went to church and fasted all day.
Wow.
1798, John Adams came on the verge of war, open war with France. He proclaimed May 9th, 1798. A day of prayer and fasting 4 days before the last battle was fought and won at New Orleans.
Isn't
that
something?
And the image of prayer was gone. Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, Lincoln. You know, Lincoln's speeches are laced with, intertwined with scriptural references,
yes.
et cetera, et cetera.
He had a joint resolution, meaning both houses of Congress discussed it on two different occasions. And they came with a joint resolution to call for prayer and fasting in our nation. And you know that the proclamation of Lincoln that Thanksgiving is a national holiday. And what our listeners, I hope, are thinking this year, not just as they're discussing all of these, you know, these serious tragedies, but how many blessings and privileges that we now enjoy.
Right, that are from God.
Were obtained for us from the prayers of our leaders.
And the fasting, not just
in government.
I love
yes.
how they mentioned not just prayer, but they strengthened their prayer with fasting.
Amen. Amen. And so if anybody wants to read more about it, I would really suggest you
What's the name of the book again? Yeah, please.
Shaping History Through Prayer and Fasting. And you can go to Derek Prince's site, www.derekprince.org.
No, that's it. Laura, thank you for doing all that research. That's so helpful and such a good way to get us set for the big holiday on Thursday.
Yeah, so, all that feasting.
Yes.
So happy Thanksgiving,
happy
listeners.
Happy Thanksgiving to all of you listeners. You are in our prayers. Please keep us in yours. We hope you have a very beautiful, blessed, and wonderful holiday with your friends and family. And don't forget to be back with us next week. We'll have an all-new, terrific show lined up for you. This has been Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich sitting in for Father Anthony. Goodbye and have a great week.
The world makes no sense. Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? Marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is wrought. It's time to be stirred. The time.